Wow. There we go. So good morning and welcome to Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class. This morning we have Dr. Steve Willing, MD, who's going to be taking the class for Hugh Ross, who's absent today, but we'll be back next week. As usual, we would like you to post your questions in the Q&A. The questions that go to the Q&A will be asked at the end of the lecture. And if you have other things that you want to discuss, you're welcome to use the chat. You can chat with each other and chat with Jamie as well if you have questions that are technical in nature. So please do post your questions to Q&A and we'll get to them at the end of the lecture. So this morning's lecture is Thinking About Believing. And with that, Dr. Steve Willing, it's all yours, sir.
All right, thank you, Mark. This morning, I want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to speak and fill in for Hugh Ross and the Paradoxes class. Those are big shoes that I'm clearly unworthy to fill, but I thank you for the opportunity nonetheless. I was pretty sure that Hugh wasn't going to be talking about sex in the foreseeable future, so there is that, maybe got me an in here. Today, I'm going to follow up from last week's talk in a very different direction. And I'll explain as we go along why we're going it from this way. The title of this talk is A State of Mind, Thinking About Believing, the View from 30,000 Feet. Now, reasons to believe, of course, you know, is an apologetics ministry. And the apposition of those two words, reasons and believing, implies that there's a connection. Well, let's dig into that connection today. What are the reasons that people believe? Now, much of what apologetics does is what we call prescriptive. In other words, telling people how they ought to think. I'm not going to be talking today about how people ought to think. I'm going to be taking the descriptive route. I'm going to talk about how people really think as opposed to how they're supposed to think. And you will see as we go along that there could be quite a big difference there. Now, 10 years ago, Barna Research came out with this book, You Lost Me. It was a follow-up of their earlier book called Unchristian. And in You Lost Me, Dave Kinman and his researchers were looking at young people who had left the church, interviewing them, examining their backgrounds, and asking them why they left. And combining that with some of the data that they have accumulated. Some of the points from this, again, this was 10 years ago and things are only more, a bigger problem now. 59% of millennials who grew up in the church dropped out at some point. And of the millennials, only 2 in 10 believe that church or faith was important. Their conclusion, on page 21, the dropout problem is at its core a faith development problem. To use religious language, it's a disciple-making problem. The church is not adequately preparing the next generation to follow Christ faithfully in a rapidly changing culture. Now, last week I talked about some of the reasons for that, and it emerges that sexuality is a wildly unappreciated component of that. Tim Keller relates a conversation he had with a campus minister. This campus minister was telling Reverend Keller, he said, when a student comes to me and they've taken a philosophy class or science class, and they say, I really am not thinking this is as true as I used to think. I'm sort of wobbling in my faith here. This campus minister says the first thing he asked them is, who are you sleeping with? Totally off subject, it would seem, but the most common response he got, he asserted, was, how did you know? So there's much evidence that there's a link there. To what degree it's recognized is somewhat of a different matter. So summarizing what I talked about last week, that there is a rapid decline in religious engagement that's driven by sex, by young people in particular, departing from the biblical sexual narrative. I further argued that the biblical paradigm for sexuality is validated by scientific research of the last 3 decades, specifically the innate difference between men and women, that biblical sexuality, monogamy between husband and wife for life, for children is optimal for human flourishing, And thirdly, that because of a fall, these things have corrupted our sexual behavior and we suffer as a consequence. And finally, that the secular narrative breeds predators. It creates a situation where they are more likely to emerge and prosper and makes victims of almost all women, almost all children, and most other men. Now, the talk today is going to come at this from a slightly different direction. When you're presenting a series of talks, you could think of it maybe in one sense as we're building a building. And the first talk, you lay the foundation. Each talk, you add an extra story to that building. And in the end, you have a big building that you've built step by step. The metaphor to think about here is a river. Last week, I talked about one major stream that's supplying that. Say last week, maybe it was the Missouri River. Today, I'm going to talk about the Ohio River. And both of those come together to provide most of the flow for the Great Mississippi. So I'm going to begin upstream in the Ohio River and talk about a whole different thread of thought and science that is going to join up with last week's talk towards the end. Now, why do we believe the things that we believe? Our underlying assumption is that we form our beliefs on the basis of facts, experience, and logic. This is the whole basis for apologetics, for education, for debate, that everything is in the realm of truth, evidence, facts, rationality. But how is it really? Well, facts, logic, and experience are there, but besides that, we have traditions, heuristics, emotions, social influences. And of these that I've listed, by far the greatest are actually emotions and social influences. This is not an expression of my opinion. This is what research has demonstrated in the last 20 or 30 years. And in fact, beliefs are like sausages, a whole bunch of issues, a whole bunch of factors ground together to get one end product, which may be unpredictable in its quality. But we'll go back to the beginning of that list and let's talk about facts. Well, it would be great if we even had access to reliable facts. But right off the bat, there are problems because facts don't deliver themselves truly and honestly, neatly packaged for our consumption. There is the issue of misinformation, which is simply false information provided to us. There is a matter of disinformation, which is false information provided with the intent to deceive. We also have the issue of information overload. Even if the truth is out there, how are you going to find it with the overwhelming amount of data and resources that we have to comb through to get there? Let's start with just the misinformation. And this picture is John Ioannidis, who's been at Stanford for quite some time. In 2005, he published an article in JAMA called Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. In this article, he looked at 49 highly cited medical papers between 1990 and 2003. 45 of these claimed effective treatments. Out of those 45, 34 were retested, and 41% of those, 14 out of 30, 41% were shown to be wrong or significantly exaggerated. So major papers in the medical literature ended up being unreliable because they couldn't be replicated. The significance of that, he's gotten very well known in the community because of that. This article from the PLOS, the Public Library of Science in 2005, is the most downloaded paper in the history of PLOS. Overall, he's been cited 85,000 times. So from misinformation, we proceed to disinformation. You may not recognize this gentleman, but this is Andrew Wakefield. He's quite well known in some circles because in 1999, he published an article in Lancet claiming to see a potential connection between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination and autism. As it turned out, the entire research project was a fraud. The British Medical Journal published this article by an investigative reporter in 2011 who went back and investigated the laboratory, Wakefield, his associates, and completely exposed how the data had been fabricated. And it turned out that Wakefield was in fact expecting to get significant financial gain from plaintiff's attorneys who are going to file these potential lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. So he, not only was it false, but he knew it was false and engaged in fraud. Now from a public perspective, there is no defense against that. There is no way that an average layperson is gonna know whether they're the victim of fraud or not. And you can easily err in the opposite direction to think that all of it's fraud, and that's every bit as dangerous. As a result of Wakefield's activity, increasing numbers of people declined to get their kids vaccinated. This is what we call the free rider effect. They're still probably going to do fine because everybody else is behaving responsibly. But this has led to significant measles outbreaks. There was an outbreak in late 2018, 2019 in Samoa that led to dozens of deaths of innocent children because they had stopped doing the measles vaccination. There was a large outbreak in the US in 2019, and by the end of the year, over 1,200 cases of measles had erupted, many, many times the baseline rate from the 1990s. As it turned out, last year with the COVID epidemic and controls, that the numbers actually plummeted as a result of social distancing and masking and taking them out of schools. So I've talked about misinformation, about disinformation. What about information overload? Well, there you have it. This is an article from the Public Discourse, a great website if you wish to check it out. The 50-50 problem, how the internet is distorting our reality. They report that more than 50% of Americans spend more than 50% of their waking hours living in virtual artificial worlds. The internet is full of sources. There is no limit to the amount of material you can be exposed to, and there's almost no way for the average person to check the validity of that. Facebook, social media, YouTube, all of these will flood you with a wildly unmanageable amount of information. How do you deal with that? Even if this is the facts problem, even if the facts are out there, how would you find them and how would you sort them out from the misinformation and the disinformation? You really just can't, not on your own. So going from facts to logic, you know, logic is important. I know that Mark Perez has talked to you about logical fallacies and Ken Samples teaches that. And we need to learn about these logical fallacies, but there's a weakness there. The weakness is thinking that teaching people logic is actually going to make them more rational. And when does that really ever happen? I don't think I've ever met somebody who says, you know, I took this logic course and it was amazing. I learned so many things that I was doing wrong. That almost never happens. What happens is it says, I took this logic course and now I can explain to you why you're wrong. Rather than using it as a mirror, which is the intent of these courses, we use it as a weapon against other people who disagree with us. So those courses are important, they're valuable. We need to learn these, but keep it in perspective and realize if you're taking this course, we're not teaching this to you to use as a weapon against other people. We're teaching you this to use it for self-examination. And then there is a matter of experience. Well, they say, you know, I think Josh McDowell always said that the man with an experience has an advantage over the man with an argument. And experience is often used. We see this all the time in the public media, the mass media. People share their stories. The problem with there is that experiences don't interpret themselves. They must be understood correctly. And we are not designed, because of some of the things I'm going to talk about as we proceed, we're not really designed to properly evaluate our own experiences. our minds are lazy and we tend to interpret our experiences in the light of the narratives we already embrace. Whatever you believe, that all of your experiences are going to be framed in that light as opposed to a different light. Now, traditions. I'm moving on from facts, logic, and experience to the things you might not have thought of initially. Now, traditions are a major contributor to beliefs, especially in the realm of religion or philosophy. This is one of my favorite slides, pictures from despair.com. Tradition, just because you've always done it that way doesn't mean it's not incredibly stupid. This is a man running away from the bulls that are about to gore him in Pamplona. Now, traditions could be bad. It could just represent persistence of a myth, but they could be good. It could represent accumulated experience. You know, the male-female marriage paradigm is an experience. It's driven by experience, became tradition because generations of people learned that it actually worked, promoted the functioning of society. Now, they can also be quite bad. In the colonial India, when the British were in control, the Hindus had persisted in this practice called sati. Widows, the survivors of their dead husbands, were considered a burden, and it was typically expected that they would throw themselves alive on the funeral pyre of their husband. This was called sati. Now, they continued to do this, and there's a British general by the name of Charles Napier who was overseeing one district, and he was determined to put an end to this barbaric practice. So they were about to stage another burning, and they were about to burn another widow. And Napier said, "No, you may not. We forbid it." The natives, the Indians, complained and said, "You're interfering with our tradition. This is our tradition. You must accommodate us." And Napier came back with his classic response, "Be it so. This burning of widows is your custom. Prepare the funeral pile. But my nation also has a custom. When men burn women alive, we hang them and confiscate all their property. Let us all act according to national customs." So which tradition would you choose? The burning the widow or hanging the murderers? Your choice. Now, heuristics is another important factor, and you may be unfamiliar with this expression. It's nothing really fancy. Heuristics are just a rule of thumb, a quick way of thinking that bypasses a detailed analysis, employing all the facts and advanced reasoning. Heuristics are how you make snap judgments, and we do it all the time. These are thoroughly described in this New York Times bestseller by Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner in economics, who did all the pioneering research in this area. Wikipedia defines heuristics as mental shortcuts that ease the cognitive load of making a decision. And Kahneman talks about two systems of thinking. System one is fast, your snap judgment, how you react most of the time. System two is the slow thinking. It's where, okay, I'm going to take some time. I'm going to reflect upon this. I'm going to research it. I'm going to get as much information as I can. We do most of our thinking in system one. This is something that Kahneman showed really beyond any question. System one, though, is gullible and biased to believe. System two is the one that's in charge of doubting and unbelieving. But system two is sometimes busy and often lazy. According to Kahneman, taking it all together, summing it up, the human mind is not bound to reality. You know, we almost never, and this is not a design flaw. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with us. If we had to use system two for every decision, we would be unable to function. So I, by no means do I want to imply that there's something wrong with us. You know, if you hear threatening noises in the jungle, or if you hear something going on in the house at night, sometimes you need to make a snap decision as to fight or flight, whether you run away or whether you stay or fight. And we, every day we have to make thousands of decisions that we have to make on a, in an instant. When you're driving, you don't have time to react to something that's happening in front of you in the chat and the traffic. You have to react immediately. And so many of our decisions are like that. So, you know, we thank God for heuristics, but we have to be careful and be aware of their limitations. The problem is when we rely on heuristics when we should be using system two. Now, what are a few examples? Availability heuristic is when we come to a belief because we see it, we're exposed to it. It's there's something called the availability cascade, and that's when an idea goes viral. Because we believe, we form our beliefs not just on the basis of the evidence that we've seen, but we also form our beliefs based on what other people believe. We think, well, if they've done the heavy lifting, if they've studied this and they came to this conclusion, then I'll go with it. But what if that person actually didn't? Or what if that person got it from somebody else? As a result, wrong beliefs can really cascade through this availability heuristic into what's called the availability cascade, where this false idea, or it could be a true idea, it's neutral as to whether it's right or wrong. But when the idea itself becomes viral and people believe it, not because of the facts, evidence, and logic, but because most other people believe it. An affective heuristic is simply an inclination to believe something that we feel good about or to reject something that we emotionally feel bad about. I'm not going to talk about all of these. Occam's razor you hear about, that's often proposed as a rule of logic, but it's not a rule of logic. Actually, it's a heuristic, and it's a really good one. Occam's razor is a principle that when you have a large amount of data to explain, that the explanation that accounts for all that data is to be preferred over invoking multiple explanations. And this is not a logical rule. Sometimes there are multiple explanations, but the preference is to condense it and explain it by a single explanation. But that's really, it's a good example of a heuristic. The representativeness heuristic is how we categorize things with which we're unfamiliar according to what we already know. If I go to a store and I see a chair I've never seen before, I know instantly that it's a chair because I have an image of a chair in my mind and that I'm using the representativeness heuristic to recognize that that is a chair. This is a great example of the representativeness heuristic. This is a scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the witch scene, if you're familiar with it. You know, they say, we found a witch, can we burn her? And Sir Bedivere says, well, how do you know she's a witch? And their response is, because she looks like one. Well, that's funny, but that's also an example of the representativeness heuristic. Because she looks like a witch, she must be a witch. And actually, this is historically accurate. In 1841, Charles Mackay wrote a book called The Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions. And in his chapter on the witch mania of the 1600s, he described how the accused were usually old, unattractive, poor, and a little odd. In other words, they looked like witches. So let's move on to the next category, and that's the one of emotions. Emotions are really underappreciated, but some of this research emerged in the 1990s and early 2000s, and they found it in certain people who sustained particular injuries to the orbitofrontal gyrus of the frontal lobe. They lost their emotional capacity, no emotional capacity, but the unexpected result is they were unable to make decisions. Something deactivated the decision-making process, and as further investigation revealed, A. Bacara wrote this paper in Brain and Cognition in 2004. The studies of decision-making in neurological patients who can no longer process emotional information normally suggest that people make judgments not only by evaluating the consequences and their probability of occurring, but also and even sometimes primarily at a gut or emotional level. A good example of this, I can think of several, but if you have read Nabil Qureshi's Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, the climax of his coming to faith was when he had learned of the fact that Islam sanctioned the rape of female prisoners of war. He was so horrified by this at an emotional level that that tipped him over the edge. Now, he didn't frame it in that word, but he had this long process of engagement leading up to this where he was operating at an intellectual level and looking at evidences for the Bible and evidences for the Quran and comparing them. But in the end, it was his personal horror at learning that this is what Islam taught that pushed him over the edge in his own decision-making process. And since we're talking about sex, sexual decision-making is heavily influenced by neurobiology. Sexual intercourse itself leads to releases of dopamine within the central nervous system. And if you're aware, dopamine is the reward system. So it reinforces that behavior and can lead to seeking more of that behavior. So sexually, when people are sexually active, that tends to lead to more sexual activity. And the best way to avoid that is not to start it in the first place. With testosterone, the male hormone, we know that higher levels of testosterone lead to gene expressions and increased aggression, increased risk-taking. It accounts for much of the male behaviors and female-male differences. Even in utero, babies are exposed to circulating levels of testosterone that affect the developing brain. Now, it's not merely the levels of testosterone itself, but also the presence of testosterone receptors on the genes that control this expression. And so blood levels themselves don't tell the whole picture. Similarly, you may have heard of oxytocin that in some popular articles has been called the love hormone or the cuddle hormone. But there's, again, very good research that it is released when women give birth and it facilitates emotional bonding between the woman and the mother. It also promotes the release of breast milk, but it's not limited to that particular situation. Oxytocin can be stimulated by expressions of physical affection, by kissing, by hugging, again, by having sex. And what this leads to is emotional bonding with the individual. Now, that doesn't make you automatically believe something, but it makes you inclined towards believing one thing versus another and can cloud one's judgment or certainly affect one's judgment, but is far removed from this cold Mr. Spock facts, logic, and experience type of thinking. In a much more recent paper from 2014, Lerner and her colleagues from Harvard summarized the prior 35 years of research. And they said that emotions constitute potent, pervasive, predictable, sometimes harmful, and sometimes beneficial drivers of decision-making across different domains. Important regularities appear in the mechanisms through which emotions influence judgment and choices. Now, on an apologetic level, Thomas Nagel, who's one of the most honest atheists in the world, wrote several years ago now, it isn't just that I don't believe in God, and naturally, I hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. I've encountered the same sort of thing, though with far less honesty, when I read Dawkins' God Delusion. What comes through Dawkins is not so much the cold, dispassionate analysis of his objections to theism. What comes through when reading Dawkins is the animosity, the intensity of hatred and contempt he has for religious believers. And that is not a matter of facts, evidence, and logic. That's a matter of emotions. Now, I've already talked about the barriers to truth seeking to some extent. The last one I want to talk about is biases. Ken Samples has recorded some podcasts and put in some articles on this. Maybe others have as well. But cognitive biases, again, Kahneman was heavily involved in this research along with some others as well. Here, biases are something that can push us away from the truth, various flaws in our thinking. So heuristics and biases operate together, but heuristics can often lead to good decisions. Biases never get you closer to the truth. There's no such thing as a beneficial bias. And I'll give you a few examples, but most of the time they're driven by self-interest. For example, let's talk about confirmation bias. Confirmation bias, you've probably heard about, that's this tendency to, if we have a pre-existing belief, we zero in and see only the evidence that supports our belief. And we tend to ignore or suppress evidence that contradicts our pre-existing belief. We look only for evidence of what we already believe. Now, smart people know about confirmation bias. They know that there is contradictory information out there, but there is a way out of this. That's called disconfirmation bias. Disconfirmation bias is, okay, I admit there are opposing arguments, but then they go through and pick them apart, looking for errors of methodology, looking for ways they can dismiss it, but doing so dishonestly, applying a standard to the disconfirming evidence that they would never dream of applying to the evidence that supports their own position. Another example of biases is a blindness to our own biases. It's called the bias blind spot. We're very good at seeing them in other people. We're very bad at identifying them among ourselves. So in that case, it's just like the logical fallacies. Now you can look up list of cognitive biases on Wikipedia. Last time I counted this, which was about 2 years ago, they are up to 194. Again, you won't be tested on that. So let's move on to social influences. You're aware of peer pressure. We always think in terms of the typical high school succumbing to peer pressure, but that doesn't end with high school at all. I talked about the availability cascade, how we tend to believe things if a lot of people believed it already. The effect of peers, the desire to be accepted by our peers, the wish to be respected by our peers. We can accommodate our beliefs to such a degree, not radically, it never happens all at once or in a 180 degree switch, but all it takes is 1 degree at a time, 2 degrees at a time. And over a period of time, you can end up in a very different place than where you started. Grandstanding is when we express things simply for the purpose of being accepted and respected by our peers and showing off our moral virtue. But that also leads to ramping up, where if someone responds in kind, you're no longer superior, so you have to ramp it up a bit and come up with an even stronger position. And lastly, mass media. And there's just no way, everything I've said so far, there's no way to understate the impact that mass media has on what people believe. More people, we've seen how over the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a radical shift in public opinion with regard to homosexuality. This has almost nothing to do with science or research in this realm. Far more minds are changed by a TV series like Will and Grace than all the research ever done put together. These things are powerful and completely shape our beliefs. In fact, humans are believing machines. We used to think there was an age of enlightenment where people abandoned all superstition and became totally rational. Then we thought we entered the age of postmodernism, where we'd given up all absolute right and wrong. We are in the age of credulity. The people are willing to believe almost anything, no matter how preposterous it may seem. But every time you assert a particular belief, that means you're rejecting something else. And with all the beliefs that are circulating in culture today, There's an accompanying rejection of the opposing beliefs. So every time the culture embraces something that violates Christian truth, that leads to a denial of Christianity itself. And common to all this, and what I thought for some time was the most fundamental, was the issue of pride. Pride is the desire for inordinate exaltation as defined by Augustine, or the inordinate desire of one's own excellence, as quoted by Aquinas. Having to thigh a thought of himself by Edwards. Pride, my definition, is an unrealistic, positive view of one's wisdom, abilities, virtue, importance, or control. In other words, overconfidence. Because everything that I said so far can be pretty harmless until you get to the point that you think you have the final answer, until you are sure you're right. It's one thing to be certain, it's another to be certain when you're wrong. Studies have repeatedly shown that a degree of certainty consistently exceeds our accuracy. And this both defines and demonstrates the phenomenon of overconfidence. You know, pride and false beliefs are causally related. If you don't realize your own limitations, you're going to be more certain in your own beliefs. And this was a theme of a blog post I had at RTB in August of 2019. I think, therefore, it must be true, the science of certainty. You might superficially think that the way out is that really smart people can avoid it, but they don't. There's an excellent book out here by David Robson, a science writer, called The Intelligence Trap. And I'm gonna skip through some of this because of matters of time, but they coined out this idea of Nobel disease. What they found is that brilliant people can go way off the rails, that extreme intelligence by no means a guarantee against error. See how many of you can identify this quote. "I honor Lenin as a man who completely sacrificed himself and devoted all his energy to the realization of social justice. I do not consider his methods practical, but one thing is certain, men of his type are the guardians and restorers of humanity." Vladimir Lenin, the guardian and restorer of humanity. Recognize the source? Albert Einstein. It's from the Einstein archives, and I'll give you a source right there. Now, research shows that smart people are more confident. Because they're more confident, they're less likely to doubt themselves or change their minds. But rather than pursuing the truth, they devote their intellect towards arguing and reinforcing their own pre-existing opinions. And in fact, there's a very weak correlation between raw intelligence and rationality. The solution, though, is something called wisdom. And wisdom is independent of native intelligence. Wisdom is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as a capacity of judging rightly in matters relating to life and conduct, soundness of judgment, and the choice of means and ends. So critical thinking is necessary, but it's not sufficient. How do we overcome intelligence and acquire wisdom? And the answer for me up until 2 years ago was the virtue of humility. Augustine talked about sin as evil, as a deprivation of good. Well, pride is not something in and of itself. Pride is a deprivation of a good, and that is the virtue of humility. We don't often think of humility as a virtue, but the Bible says it is. It's the defining virtue of Jesus, who sacrificed himself. That's the whole theme of the first section of Philippians 2, that he humbled himself and became born as a man. Humility in the intellectual realm is accepting that one's knowledge and understanding will always be incomplete and allowing for the possibility of being mistaken. Richard Feynman, who's one of the smartest men who ever lived and a key atomic researcher, said the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. We cannot choose not to be wrong. We can choose not to be arrogant. So this is how we ended. In summary, and I'm not over yet, false beliefs make poor disciples. There's much more to it than facts and arguments. Humans are believing machines. We're not in the Enlightenment. We're in the age of credulity, and we have been for quite some time. it's really hard to know the truth. There are pitfalls no matter which way you try to go. But seek wisdom over intelligence and recognize the dangers of pride and embrace, practice, and preach humility. So that's where I would have ended this talk 2 years ago. That's where I did end this talk 2 years ago. But in the last couple of years, God has gotten something else on my mind that I had seriously overlooked. So what did I miss? The basis of belief as it really, really is, what I had overlooked was the role of spiritual influences. Think about this. If we accept the Bible as authoritative, it doesn't fall in any of those categories. It comes through revelation. Well, if there are positive spiritual influences, then maybe there are negative spiritual influences. It is a clear teaching of Scripture that dark spiritual forces have great power in this world. So where are we going to go with this? Let's talk about spiritual warfare for a minute, because this is the essence of where false beliefs can come. Begin with the great deceiver. The primary weapon at the disposal of Satan and his legions is the power to deceive and manipulate. You see this in Revelation 20, three times Satan is referred to as the great deceiver. Think of all the things that he could be accused of. Think of all the things that he is blamed for in this world. How often does deception come to your mind? But it should. And it's not just Satan. I think C.S. Lewis really did have it in Screwtape Letters. What power do they wield? We cannot answer this by science. I make no pretense to that. But we can deduce this from Scripture. Number one, they can tempt. They tempt. John 13, 27 talks about how Satan entered the mind of Judas to betray him. In Acts 5, 3, it says, Peter says to Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land for yourself? In Matthew 4 is the account of Satan's temptation of Jesus. So they tempt. They can plant ideas. 1 Chronicles 21 talks how the census of Israel and Judas. Now, Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. Now, this is strange. So the census was actually an idea that Satan put in David's mind. Matthew 16, 21 through 23, you know this story where Jesus says he's going to go to Jerusalem and die. And Peter says, no, I won't let this happen. And Jesus' response is, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me. Now, often this is seen as, well, Jesus is just saying this to Peter, but that's the exact same response that Jesus used directly to Satan during the account of the temptations. I believe, and many, many commentators through history have said, that Jesus is addressing Satan here, and that the idea that Peter thought was his own came from another source. And lastly, they can recruit. John 8, 44 talks, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees and says, you are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. So knowing the power, we're not talking about spinning heads and levitation or anything exotic. We're talking about things that almost any level are undetectable by our own natural senses. So what techniques do they use? They can quote Scripture. Satan quoted Scripture quite a bit in his temptation of Christ. They tempt with sex. That's how we're starting to come together here. 1 Corinthians 7, 5, do not deprive one another except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I mentioned they plant ideas. They facilitate the spread of disinformation. And the internet has made that ever more possible. A single person with access to the internet has access to 5 billion possible listeners. This has never been true in the history of the human race. And they zero in on our pride. We are most easily deceived when we are told what we want to be true, whether it's how wonderful we are or how it's okay if we lower our standards here. It's okay if we do this. We are very easily deceived when we are told what we want to hear. What are their objectives? Now, some of these, I think, are things that you would have thought of yourself. Definitely, they seek to impede the ministry of the church, to impede the spread of the gospel, to keep people from seeking and finding the truth. But I don't think that's all. I think there is a broader objection. They simply want to maximize human misery. And that is something as vulgar and base as that. There's a thought that because the Bible says someday we will judge the angels, that they realize that they are going to have it coming. They're going to get us before we have that chance. How do we recognize satanic, demonic involvement? And I don't think there are telltale clues. I think it would be disastrous to go around to individuals or go around to different groups and say, well, you're just saying that because Satan has told you that. No, we don't want to go there. But what are clues? We need to be at least aware of this. Falsehood, divisions, church splits, people leaving over minor doctrinal issues, pride, judgmentalism, strife, conflict, ultimately self-destruction. When people do things that are just ultimately harmful to themselves and to those around them, that could be a sign of demonic involvement. Now, I think it would be fair to ask, Dr. Willing, are you willing to come out and declare that?
Sorry, I couldn't hear what you said.
Anything is demonic. And yes, I will. I'm willing to go out on a limb and say that historic anti-Semitism is of demonic origin. When I study history, the lies, the hatred, the destruction, even to the point that it was self-defeating to the people who were perpetrating it, I honestly believe that historic anti-Semitism is of demonic origins. And I also believe that the contemporary sexual narrative is being demonically influenced. There just doesn't seem to be any other way to account for people believing some things that are just so wildly unbelievable. So what are we to do? Well, as I said, what we don't do is start telling people, oh, you're just saying that because Satan told you. Bible gave us a manual on this, and it's in Ephesians chapter 6. Number one, recognize the nature of the battle. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Number two is study. And not just the Bible. It's not sufficient to study the Bible and nothing else. Study all the other disciplines that are relevant to your own particular sphere of influence, and be familiar and be acquainted with the arguments of the secular culture, and be aware and acquainted with the refutations of these. That's verse 14 of Ephesians. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth. Let's extend this traditional definition of truth being just what the Bible says to truth being all truth, because all truth is God's truth. And on number three, we come full circle, because I said at the very beginning of my talk last week that prayer is often offered as a simplistic response to the crisis facing the church. And I do believe prayer has a tremendous role. And 6:18 of Ephesians, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. But we need to pray as Jesus did. And I've been heavily involved in the church my whole life. And in this particular domain that I've been talking about, I think it's almost never that I've heard people pray as Jesus taught us. Well, how did Jesus tell us to pray? He said, don't use many words. I've been to many prayer meetings where people would use a lot of words. They would go on for 30, 40, 60 minutes. But when Jesus taught us the prayer, we are given the Lord's Prayer. And if you say it out loud, it takes about 20 seconds. But there's a key verse there. You probably learned it as deliver us from evil. Well, it turns out that deliver us from evil is probably better translated deliver us from the evil one. There's a definite article. It's hopaneros. The same phrase appears back in Ephesians again, in verse 16 of Ephesians 6, from taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. This is a clear reference to Satan. It uses the same phrase, hope and arrows. Now, since I've read this, I've started more consciously praying to be delivered from deception. And again, you got to be careful with this. He didn't say pray that they will be delivered from the evil one, but deliver us from the evil one. So when I pray first that I be protected from deception. Second, that my family be protected from deception. And third, that my church be protected from deception. If we are to be prayed, if we pray to God, deliver us from the evil one, and his main tool is deception, what does that amount to? It means we need to be praying against deception. And lastly, number four, be humble. If we know our limitations, we're much more likely to, we're less likely to be prone to temptation. We're less likely to be deceived and played by Satan because he knows our weak points. So how do we respond to the sexual revolution? Coming back full circle now, ministering to the victims, making our churches a place of refuge, forceful discipline against predatory behavior, challenge the narrative with stories because people are much more influenced by stories than facts, evidence, and logic. Promote earlier marriage, shut off the spigot of propaganda that I talked about. And lastly, maybe most importantly, employ the weapons of spiritual warfare that I discussed. And some of these I've talked about on my website at in a blog post I've had at RTB and also at the Soggy Spaniel that I run at esfling.com. And I will stop now and open it for questions. If you don't have enough questions, I have a few of my own that I threw in that you should have asked. Thank you. Mark, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Steve. We don't have any questions in the Q&A yet, but one of the questions that I had that arose as I was listening to you was, given that there are so many different kinds of deception and that the church, particularly the conservative church as I've seen it, seems to be focusing more and more on politics, and some of the politics really is hostile. Is that the kind of study that you would countenance or that you were considering when you talked about that we should be studying not just the Bible, but also other things in the domains that we have influence in?
Could you clarify? Do you mean like studying to be more acquainted with the political arguments or public?
Yes. Policy? For example, I've had people talk to me and say, well, you know, we need to talk more about what a woke church would be and show the problems of that. I'm not sure that that's such a great idea, but my question to you is that a reasonable idea given the potential for the cultural influence to infect the church?
Yes, especially with the youth. When a cultural narrative takes hold that is influencing a large number of people, now I'm not passing judgment on any particular one, but if it contradicts biblical truth, if it contradicts secular truth, we have a duty to uphold it. Now I'm also of the mind, you know, you choose your battles. And, you know, maybe in your situation, that's the most critical issue facing you. Maybe it's not. The theme of my talk last week, the undercurrent is that to a large degree, I think it's a distraction because what's really throwing the church off the rails, what's really leading to the decline is not these philosophies, but just normal garden variety routine sexual activity among young people raised in the church. And, you know, if you're addressing the issues there of casual sex, of extramarital sex, of premarital, if you're addressing those issues in a thoughtful, sober way and covering it adequately, then yeah, I'm going to move on to the other ones. But if you're focused on wokeness, if you're focused on critical race theory, but you're not protecting your rear, you're vulnerable and attack, and not just vulnerable, that's where we're being attacked, is from the rear. You have to choose your battles for sure.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned was that the use of stories is very influential in the way that we form beliefs. As we train our young people in the church to avoid premarital sex, to, particularly if they're engaged in it already, to help them withdraw from that, especially the problem given that it's so attractive in many senses, even including, you know, the dopaminergic effect of it. What kind of stories do we tell young people to help withdraw them from that practice?
Well, one suggestion I would make would be to start focusing on the victims, because there are definitely victims. There's a young fella, I don't have his name on the top of my tongue, I've referenced him on my website, who became a counselor in a rape crisis center, and he has published a book of stories of accounts. And that would be one place really to begin, because that's completely at odds with the narrative that there are no victims, that it's harmless, that it's maybe even healthier than the repressed sexual Victorian sexuality of Christianity. That's completely challenged that narrative. We're past postmodernism because we are not at the age of moral relativism. It's no longer an issue of, well, you have your morals, I have mine. They are claiming, first of all, absolute morality. They're claiming absolute moralism on matters of race and sex, and they're claiming that they have the high ground. And to that degree, I believe they overplay their hand. They were better off with a moral relativism, because when they are claiming the moral high ground, then we have the evidence that says, no, these beliefs lead to vast amounts of harm. They harm children, they harm most women, they harm most men. And those are the stories that need to be told. You know, we saw it have this great, spectacular, flashy, feature-length documentary film from as Genesis history. I would love to see something that says, is Christian sexuality true? And if resources that were put into that, we're putting into promoting a healthy sexual narrative, it would have, I think, far, far more beneficial impact than the movie I referenced.
Interesting. Thank you very much. It looks like there's some questions coming in. Let me see what we got here. Norm Helgeson asks, speaking of all truth, what is it and how do we look for it?
Oh, that's a good question. You have to approach, I think, starting with the attitude of humility. David Robson in The Intelligence Trap talked a lot of the book was about healthy practices and things like lifelong learning, never thinking you've got it all figured out. Having an attitude of curiosity. You read not because you have to, but because you want to. But when you have competing narratives, I think one thing that I think is, it sounds so pedantic, but I think is really powerful, is majority rules. You know, that there are problems there within the church. I think that's a really valid principle for church doctrine, the things that are probably non-compromisable. I mean, fundamental truths of the Christian faith, the matters of the creeds, they've been affirmed by the church from the very beginning throughout church councils. Now, you can find periods in history where they were rejected by one group or another, but I think the same thing applies. There are very few things there are probably a lot of things where the majority is wrong, but for instance, let's say in your own Sunday school class, if you have a view that is at odds with what 90% of the rest of your class believes, that should be a red flag at least. Doesn't mean you're wrong, but you should be a little bit less confident in your opinion. Same thing with a denomination. If one denomination holds a view that's rejected by 90% of the remaining denominations, that should be a red flag as well. When a scientist embraces a view that's rejected by 99% of Christian scientists, that should be a red flag. So, you know, most people, unless you're an expert in your field, you're always at the mercy of experts. And we have to avoid the tendency of just choosing experts who tell us what we already believe or that tell us what we want to hear, what we already agree with. We have to respect the opinions of experts who are at least proceeding from the same set of principles, like the truth of scripture.
Yes. I've noticed that when you were presenting some of your case, you used statistics, which I thought were marvelously accurate, but they had a much more profound effect on me than I would wonder whether it has on other people. We have this confirmation bias. We want to find what confirms what we already believe. And yet the statistics would disconfirm a lot of beliefs, particularly people, even people in the church, who believe that sex before marriage is not a problem. That's just a moral question. It's not a big deal. Have you, in the discussions you've had with other people in other churches and other presentations you've made, found that the statistics, particularly the statistics you gave today in this class and last week, on the problems that result from premarital sex, you know, the predatory practices, the rise in sexually transmitted diseases, the rise in psychological problems, do those have an effect on the young people that are most at risk?
Whoever posed that question must think I have a lot more experience in this area than I have. I'm pretty new to this game, so I can't draw my own experience. I don't know anybody who's doing this with you. I know in past years they've used different approaches and including talking about the risk of sexually transmitted diseases and trying to convince young people to abstain. And as I pointed out, that's kind of a non-starter among at least males who are already risk takers. So I don't have experience. I'd like to see it tried, but I also am, that's why I concluded with what I did. I think we really have to view these things as spiritual battles and start focusing in on Ephesians 6 and what are the weapons of the faith and pray for these people. I mean, I think it would be irresponsible to not talk about them. I think it'd be irresponsible not to teach them. I wish I would see more churches doing it. My church does some. I'd like to see them do more. I'd like to see all the churches involved, but you'd have to do it responsibly and not pass on false information, because that would really undermine the whole objective.
Yeah, there are some problems with that. I think some churches and some church leaders, they go off the rails by not being attentive to their research quality. All right, let's see. We have a question from Don Hank, who says, if it is not a sidetrack, could you comment a little bit more on the man that says, oh, who are you sleeping with? I was taken aback by how matter of fact he was, even though it is obvious it does deceive. Or were you saying it is the effect? Sorry, a little busy when it was said. Does the question make sense to you?
I'm not sure, but let me clarify. This was something I only know about third hand, that somebody has written an article about a personal conversation with Tim Keller, where Tim Keller, or maybe it was at a conference, but somebody's reporting what Tim Keller reported that somebody told him. So this is way removed. Okay. But he did present it that Keller thinks that this has a ring of truth to it.
Okay, thank you. Norm Helgeson asks, deception, is this not the critical issue in our societal problems and problem solving? What can we do to counter this?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And what I close with is spiritual warfare is, I think, what we have to do to counter, to pray as Jesus taught us to pray, to deliver us from the evil one, which is to pray to be delivered from deception. And I'm going to be repeating myself at this point, but he didn't say deliver them from the evil one. He said deliver us from the evil one.
Yes.
So we, you know, it doesn't do any good to pray that for other people unless you're willing to pray for yourself. And my thrust here has been a problem in the world today because of a declining influence of the church. There's only one place to look for a cause of that, and that's the church. you know, falling down on its job in some way. What have we missed? And I think there's a lack of humility you see a lot of, and maybe a lack of appreciation on spiritual warfare. And I'm not saying anything. This is not, nothing in the last 2 weeks is Steve Willing. What really got me going on this, I think, first of all, maybe just the idea popped in my head. You know, they talk, there's actually this thing in research called spontaneous thought. And where do these thoughts come from that seem unrelated to the task at hand and unrelated to our context where we are living currently? And truth is, you know, they don't really understand it, but it's apparently a real enough thing that people are wanting to research this idea of spontaneous thought. Well, maybe some of these spontaneous thoughts come from demonic realm, and some, and a lot of, I mean, Christians always, for all my life, have said God told me this. I don't know how literally they mean that, but they means that what they're saying is they had a spontaneous thought and they believe that it was brought to them by God, that God brought it to mind. Now, if we accept that as true, which most, at least a lot do, then why would the other not be equally true, that these spontaneous thoughts can come from the demonic realm? Now, this is not, it's, I think I showed sufficiently that scripture teaches this happens. There are documented cases where, and if it wasn't for the omniscient narrator, we wouldn't know. I mean, an outside observer would never have known that Satan put the idea in Peter's mind of stopping Jesus from going to Gethsemane. And a reporter wouldn't have known that Satan inspired David to take the sentence. It's only because you have the omniscient narrator that explains it. Well, the same thing works in the present realm. We don't have any objective way of knowing whether an idea came from Satan or the demons. And I, you know, but there are, on the other hand, there's not an absence of empirical evidence either. There are a couple of people I would bring to mind. Billy Hollowell has a book came out in September called Playing with Fire. And it's about, this is more focused on exorcisms, possessions, the supernatural manifestations of demonic activity. But he does write, he actually takes pains to emphasize that this is really the exception. He goes on to show that some really powerful documentation, empirical documentation of these things. But also he consulted with many theologians and says that this is really not their norm, that what I talked about, the deception, is really how they mostly operate. Another person with a lot of empirical experience in this is a psychologist with Columbia University named Richard Gallagher. He's a Catholic and he's a psychiatrist. And a few decades ago, he was asked by some priests to come in and evaluate candidates for exorcism because they were being conscientious. They wanted to exclude psychiatric disorders. And he approached this with a highly skeptical frame of mind, saying he believed that they would be psychiatric disorders. But fairly soon into this, he became convinced through direct personal experiences that there were supernatural things going on. So there's empirical evidence for all that. But I think we need to take it seriously. I've gone off the tracks before. I forgot where we started.
Oh, you're going the right direction. Thank you very much. That was, the nexus is very tight. Doug McComb asks, what do you say to someone who says that marriage is just a piece of paper? It seems that males say this more than females. Have you noticed this?
I've heard it. I don't know how you want to address that. It kind of affirms what I said last week, that males dominate the market for sex and females dominate the market for marriage. And it kind of a good segue to the question that they should have asked. That is a good, very good question, because there are actually two questions, I think, that address that. So the first question I think they should have asked is, why don't women organize to demand more of men? Because I was making it sound like, well, this is a rotten deal for women, but they're acquiescing. You know, if they just stood up, men would behave more responsibly. Women don't have to go to bed with these guys. If they didn't go to bed with these guys, then they'd have an incentive to marry them. Regner has talked about, I think correctly, is the prisoner's dilemma. Mark, you should be able to explain the prisoner's dilemma if you want, or I'll do it.
No, you do it.
You know, the prisoner's dilemma is you arrest two people who are part of a conspiracy. You separate them, you take one into one room and the other into another room, and they cannot communicate with one another. You tell one of them that if he confesses, if he confesses and provides evidence against the other, he can go free. Well, if their success is maximized if neither one of them confesses it, because the situation is designed so that if one of them doesn't confess, they both go free, because that's the only way to get any evidence. So the winning strategy is to remain silent, but they're not thinking of the winning strategy. They're thinking, what happens if the other guy confesses? If I play the game right and I stay silent and the other guy cheats, then I'm a chump and I lose. So women are sort of caught in this dilemma as well, because if only a handful of women decide, well, I'm going to stick to my standards, there are just too many who are willing to step into the breach and meet that sexual demand. And so you would really have to have a really high number of women on board for a strategy like that to work. And things like that just don't ever happen. The other side of that question, similarly, is why should a man care about anything I said when he's getting what he wants? And to that I'd say, most men are not sexual predators. I think all men could be given the right circumstances, but most men are not sexual predators. Most men, you know, really want a relationship. They want to love, they want to be loved. They want those things. Most men want to get married eventually. So I think the way to communicate it to men is that it is the moral high ground, that explain to them that it's not in their long-term interests. It's hurtful to women, regardless of whether they're cooperating. That may not be really what they want. It's definitely hurtful to the children, and presented in that way, because there will always be predators, and nothing's going to work against a man who just decided he's out for sex and he doesn't care what the consequences are. I just don't think that is an accurate description of how most men are.
Okay, thank you. I had a couple of comments. One of them was that Focus on the Family organization has been collecting data on sex before marriage issues for a while. That comes from Mark Durham. Thank you, Mark. Doug McComb asks whether you can comment on people born with two sets of sex organs, I guess opposite sex organs. Is God to blame for this? And how is one to determine the gender in that case? It seems like these are birth defects and should be handled philosophically as such. Usually one gender tends to be dominant even in these cases. Am I correct in my logic and facts?
I'm not aware of any situation where they're born with both, although I'm not pretending to be an expert in these matters. I'm just teaching what other people have. Everybody has a genetic identity. You either have two X chromosomes or an X and a Y. So genetically, everybody's either male or female, except for a couple of exceptions. There's Turner syndrome, which has no Y chromosome at all. They have a single X chromosome and they tend to do very poorly, but that's Turner's. And then there's an XXY, I think that's Klinefelter syndrome, where they have an extra X, it's a man, they have a Y chromosome, they have an extra X chromosome. Those are rare exceptions, but the overwhelming majority, they're either X or Y. They're either male or female, double X or XY. And it seems like what the research says is the best thing for them is usually going to be treat them as they genetically are, that's how their minds are being shaped in utero. That's how they're pre-programmed according to their genetic sex. And beyond that, in the clinical realm, it becomes immensely complicated and should be left to the experts. But realize that there's been a huge amount of politicization of this matter, and especially in the last 10 to 20 years. And so, you know, and the pendulum has swung, especially in transsexuality, which seems to be consuming all the oxygen of the last 5 years. The UK has just shut down all gender transitioning upon minors after the Keira Bell case. She was a young woman who had gender dysphoria, and they did a hysterectomy, removed her ovaries, did a mastectomy, put her on male hormones, and it was a disaster. She realized they did this when she was a young teen, and she, in her early 20s, realized that she made a tragic mistake. Her legal argument was that at her early young age, she was unable and unqualified to give informed consent or to possibly imagine what the implications of this might be. She returned to embracing a female identity, sued the National Health Service. They lost in British's High Court. That's not the Supreme Court, but as a result of this court case, they shut down all transitioning upon minors. Now it just happened in last week's news that in Sweden, the Karolinska Institute and most of the other major institutes in Sweden were abandoning gender transitioning treatment. I don't know the scope of that, whether it was just minors or all comers, but there's been a lot of this that's not been based on the science, and it's been highly controversial. If you go to Public Discourse, the website I reported yesterday, they have a long interview with Paul McHugh. For a couple of decades, he was the chair of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. He shut down the gender transitioning identity clinic that had been started by John Money that I talked about last week, the guy who did the fraud with the Reimer twins. Paul McHugh shut down that clinic and put an end to surgical treatments for transsexualism. And you can read the whole account of that and how it was never based on science. And when they shut it down, the plastic surgeons were actually grateful because they hated doing these mutilating type of procedures, removing healthy organs, but they felt obligated to because the referrals had been made. Well, when Paul McHugh shut down the gender transition clinic, they stopped making the referrals and the plastic surgeons were not outraged, they were relieved. So this is a long answer, but the original question was asking about ambiguous situations, and you have to be very careful. And probably a long answer is appropriate because these do have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Anybody who comes up with an aphorism that, you know, this is the answer, they obviously don't know what they're talking about.
Okay, Tom, that's a very terse way of putting it, and I think you're absolutely right. Well, we're out of questions and we're out of time. So was there anything that you wanted to conclude with, Steve, before we punch out?
I had one question that I thought should be asked. We had two of them. The last one is, how do these principles relate to abuse within the church? And I think that's an important one to address. I mean, probably most of you are aware of the Ravi Zacharias thing has been merged, and just about everything that can be said about him has been said already. But how do these things happen? And I think if we can't rise to the challenge of the sexual revolution, we don't deserve to be having a voice in public affairs. You know, the churches must first and foremost be a safe place. If the churches are not a safe place for the women and children, and we got to get back to basics. And how do these things sort of happen? Well, like I said, all the obvious things have been said about Zacharias, but I want to talk for a minute about the moral communities theory principle. The moral communities was a phrase first coined by Durkheim, who's the founder of modern sociology. But Rodney Stark, whom some of you know of as a sociologist who did more research on this. And the idea of moral communities is that our own behavior, good or bad, is affected, is influenced by the people we're with. Now, take a Christian who's trying to live by Christian life. Maybe before he was a Christian, there was a 50% chance he would steal, and then maybe after he becomes a Christian, that's reduced to a 20% chance he might steal. Well, who is he going to be around? If he's surrounded by people who agree that stealing is immoral, then he's going to be even less likely to do it. But if he's surrounded by people who think stealing is okay, he's going to be more likely to do it. You know, so there are two factors in our behavior, our own internal moral code, but we're also influenced for better or for worse by the people around us. Well, let's translate that into sexuality. If a young single person is convinced that most of his or her peers are sexually active, they're more likely to do it regardless of what their own predisposing inclination would have been. If they're convinced that most people are not doing it, they're going to find it easier to resist. And this thing can impact us. I mean, never underestimate the effect of culture. Pornography, it definitely, even if it's something on the internet, on your iPhone, the privacy of your room, it is known a contributing factor to misogyny and sexual predation. So churches need to be a safe place and moral communities matter.
Thank you. It sounds like a good argument for a youth church group for people who are abstinent. Sounds like it would be a good place for them to have their the effect of the group who would be a good influence on them, for a place for them to go. So with that, thank you very much, Dr. Willing. We sincerely appreciate you taking so much time, so much effort in all of this. We need to know how to think as much as what to know as we need to know what to think. And you've done a fantastic job of helping us to learn how to think. So with that, Lord bless you. Thank you very much for being here, Dr. Willing. And for the rest of the group who are watching, Dr. Ross will be here next week, and we hope to see you then. Meanwhile, blessings to everyone. Go with God, go in peace. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.